It's Friday, July 17th, 2026, and this is Pip Install, your daily download on power, security and the machines. Last night the President went on primetime and told the country its elections are, his word, catastrophically insecure, declassifying a stack of intelligence to make the case and reviving his oldest grievance in the process. Our job this morning is the boring, essential one, separating what those documents show from what was said about them. Then, the Iran war's real price tag, an internal estimate that's triple what the public's been told. Artificial intelligence steps into the military's kill chain, and a World Cup final built for one last messy miracle. Let's install today's update. Start where the country's attention was last night. Prime time, the White House East Room, the President addressing the nation about its own elections. Stack, what he actually said.
25 minutes, and the headline was a declassification. The President said he was releasing intelligence documents that, he claimed, expose America's elections as dangerously compromised. He laid out five major areas of concern, and the centerpiece was a stunner. That beginning in 2020, China pulled off what he called the largest compromise of election data in history. The illicit acquisition of 220 million American voter files. He added a Homeland Security figure of roughly 250,000 non-citizens on the rolls across four states: California, New Jersey, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. And he tied all of it to one ask: pass the Save America Act, his stalled overhaul that would require proof of citizenship and voter ID. Here's the core of it in his voice.
Revealing shocking vulnerabilities in our election infrastructure.
Freya, what's actually established and what isn't?
Precision is the whole job here, so let's be precise. Declassifying a document that alleges a vulnerability is not the same as proving one, and it is nowhere near proving a past election was changed. On the record, the US intelligence community, under both the Biden and the Trump administrations, reviewed the 2020 election, and neither found credible evidence that any foreign government altered a single vote or touched the count. And hold that centerpiece claim to the same standard, because acquiring voter files, registration data, much of which is public record by law, is a world away from altering a vote. A database breach is a security problem. It is not a stolen election. On last night's other specifics, Nevada's own Secretary of State flatly rejected the claim that thousands of non-citizens sit on its rolls. And reporters reading the very documents the White House posted online during the speech found that many of them simply don't support the sweeping conclusions drawn from them. So here is the honest sentence. The President declassified allegations, presented them as proof, and asked the country to rewrite its voting laws on the strength of the framing.
Stack, the so what? Because this isn't really about 2020.
It's about 2026. Watch the mechanism, not the grievance. This is intelligence being declassified in service of a political argument, timed months before a midterm to push one specific bill. And it doesn't stand alone. That same word, declassified, is doing a lot of work this week. The President's pick to run all of US intelligence, Jay Clayton, sat in his confirmation hearing and would not say plainly that Joe Biden won in 2020. The same week, his administration is subpoenaing four New York Times reporters over a national security story. Line those up, the address, the nominee, the subpoenas, and the pattern isn't subtle. The machinery of intelligence, the person who'd run it, and the press that checks it, all bending around one man's story about elections. Whether the Save America Act ever passes matters less than the precedent being set, that the word declassified can now launder an allegation straight into a headline.
Watch two things. Whether a single one of those documents survives contact with an expert reading, and whether election security quietly becomes the license to decide who counts the votes in 2026. To the war. Because while the cameras were pointed at Washington last night, the Strait of Hormuz ground through its sixth straight day of American fire. Freya.
6 days now. And on Thursday, the United States widened the map. Strikes reaching into northern Iran, hammering Tehran again and the port of Bandar Abbas, which happens to house the headquarters of Iran's navy. Iran answered the way it has all week. Missiles at American bases across the Gulf, Kuwait, Bahrain, Jordan. But the blockade itself has settled into something colder and more routine. Central Command's own tally for the day. American forces redirected three commercial ships trying to run the line, disabled one that wouldn't comply, and boarded another to force it. That's the new normal at the mouth of the Gulf. The US Navy stopping, turning, and climbing aboard other nations' ships, one after another, in the world's most important oil corridor.
Stack, the toll on the water and the market.
The toll is the part that doesn't trend. Independent trackers now count roughly 56 separate attacks or incidents on shipping since this began, and 17 mariners dead. Not soldiers, merchant crews, the men who move the oil, caught in a war they have no stake in. And the market has simply accepted the squeeze. Traffic through Hormuz is down to a trickle. Barely 20 ships a day, where there were 100. And millions of barrels are sitting offline, as they have since spring. The price isn't spiking anymore, it's just permanently elevated. A war premium baked into every tank of fuel from Rotterdam to Ohio. This is what a choke point war does when it stops being a shock and becomes a condition.
Bash, the bill. The real one.
Here's the number they didn't want printed. Publicly, the administration says this war has cost about $30 billion. Internally, and this is the Pentagon's own estimate, leaked by people who've seen it, the real figure is $80 to $100 billion. Once you count repairing the bomb bases, replacing the aircraft that aren't coming back, and refilling the weapons we've burned through. Roughly three times what they say out loud. One independent analysis put it at $103 billion in 120 days, and there is no plan to pay for it. No tax, no budget line, no accounting. Just a war financed on the country's credit card, while the public's told it costs a third of what it does. Let me keep both halves honest, the way this show always does. The theocracy in Tehran started this. It taxed the sea. It fired on its neighbors, it earned the response. And an American war can be justified and still be lied about to the people paying for it. $100 billion is a moral fact, not just a fiscal one. Somebody's grandchildren are paying that bill, and they haven't been told.
Watch the cost estimate. When the internal number leaks louder than the public one, the war just lost the argument at home. And keep counting the crews. Nayar beat, and today the machines took a real step into the war. Stack, the doctrine.
The Pentagon quietly rewrote how it targets. A revised doctrine, out this week, fields what it calls AI-enabled tools for battle management, decision support, and, the load-bearing word, targeting. The whole point is speed, shrinking what the military calls the sensor-to-shooter cycle, the time between a system seeing something and a weapon reaching it. The chief digital and AI officer, Cameron Stanley, put it this way: an interoperable network of AI agents that gives commanders faster access to better information while keeping human judgment at the center of every targeting decision. And the department was careful to add the guardrail out loud. A human is always in the loop. The AI does not, quote, autonomously select or strike targets.
Sit with the tension in that sentence, because it's the whole future in one breath. The purpose of the tool is to make the kill chain faster. The promise is that a human still decides. Those two things pull in opposite directions, because every second you shave off the sensor-to-shooter cycle is a second shaved off the human's time to think. So what? The guardrail isn't the sentence "a human is in the loop." The guardrail is how much time that human is actually given. Watch for that number. Nobody's published it. Because in a live war against a real coastline, faster tempo is exactly the pressure that quietly turns a decision into a rubber stamp. The machines didn't take the trigger today. They took the clock. And finally, because the world still keeps a ball in the air, the last two teams standing. Heap.
Oh, this one's poetry. The World Cup final is set, and it is everything. Sunday, MetLife Stadium, just outside New York, Argentina versus Spain. The first time these two have ever met in a final at the end of the first 48-nation World Cup. And it's a generational handoff wearing cleats. On one side, Lionel Messi, 38 years old, almost certainly his last World Cup, dragging Argentina through on the kind of late magic that broke England's heart on Wednesday. On the other, Lamine Yamal, Spain's 19-year-old, the kid who wasn't born when Messi won his first Ballon d'Or, and who plays like he's been here 100 times. The old king and the heir, 90 minutes, one trophy. You could not script it better. Whatever else is burning in the world this week, for a few hours Sunday, 100 million people are going to watch a 38-year-old try to hold off the future. And honestly, good. We need it.
That's your install for Friday, July 17th. Watch whether those declassified documents survive an expert reading versus the way they were sold. Watch whether the Iran war's internal price tag forces an honest accounting. And Sunday, watch a 38-year-old try to hold off the future. The analysis is Anna Dudley's. I just handed you the update. I'm Pip. Package install success. We'll see you on the next install.